Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a language expert argues that digital communication isn't ruining our language skills, but improving them.
First, a new study finds attorneys in Wisconsin who represent low-income defendants aren't paid enough to provide adequate defense.
The Sixth Amendment Center conducted the study called Justice Shortchanged. They found the $40 per hour rate for appointed attorneys in Wisconsin is the lowest rate in the country. And the authors say that means defendants who are provided an attorney by the state aren't getting the effective defense they're guaranteed under the Constitution.
David Carroll is with us now to talk about the study. He's executive director of the Sixth Amendment Center. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, when we hear $40 an hour, it sounds, if we compare it to wages, pretty good. Why isn't that enough for a court-appointed attorney to represent a defendant?
Well, to have a legal business, there's certain expenses that you have to make each month. That's generally called overhead expenses, things like insurance and having an office. And in 2013, the Wisconsin State Bar Association determined that the average overhead rate in Wisconsin is almost $42 an hour, which means attorneys lose money taking the court-appointed counsel cases at $40 an hour.
Now, how much does Wisconsin rely on these appointed attorneys?
The bulk of cases are handled by staffed public defenders, but when there's a conflict, like when there's co-defendants, the public defenders can't handle those cases, so it has to go to private attorneys. The problem is that the Constitution doesn't care if you're co-defendant A or co-defendant B. You still have to require, you're still required to provide the same level of competent representation.
Does this happen often, this situation, or there has to be this outside attorney?
It does. It happens quite frequently.
So I guess the big question here is, you say the overhead's over $40 an hour, the pay is $40 an hour. Does this ultimately affect the quality of representation for the defendants in these cases?
It does. So just to give your audience an understanding, if you look at a state like South Dakota, which has a far lower cost of living than, you know, if you look at the urban centers of Milwaukee or Madison. In that state, there's a court rule that sets the compensation rate at $90 an hour, more than double what it is in Wisconsin right now. Similarly, there's a case out of Mississippi in which the Supreme Court down there determined that attorneys are entitled to both a reasonable fee and overhead rates. And the overhead rate was set at almost $35 an hour down there. Now, that case is now 25 years old. So if you look at the cost of living between the Mississippi Delta and Madison, for instance, and think that, you know, it's barely covering the cost of what it takes to have a legal business in 1990s Mississippi.
We're talking to David Carroll from the Sixth Amendment Center, looking at a new study on compensation for publicly appointed defense lawyers. And David, how much would a lawyer make? If I'm a lawyer, I'm representing somebody privately, not appointed by the courts, by the state. How much do I make per hour? And is the difference enough to lure people from doing one and maybe keep them from wanting to do these court-appointed stints?
I don't know the exact rate, but generally you need to be competitive with the private rates. For instance, in federal appointed cases, the compensation rates are $125 or $150 per hour, significantly above those $40 an hour rate. And so it needs to be competitive. No one expects that it's going to be equal to what someone can get for a private rate. But if you're an attorney and you have the choice to either take something that's going to net you $150 an hour or a case that's going to net you $40 an hour in which you lose money, chances are the attorneys are going to go for the higher cases.
Did you, I think you surveyed as part of this report a bunch of attorneys in Wisconsin. Did you hear from them that they were avoiding these court-appointed cases?
Yes, to be fair, a number of attorneys have said they take these cases because they think out of a sense of duty to the bar they should take these cases. And there's those attorneys that think, you know, if they provide effective representation in a high-profile case, it'll help their private business. But for the most part, attorneys responded that they are less and less inclined to take these cases. And more importantly, it showed that when they do take these cases, they don't contribute as much time as they do on their private cases. They don't file as many motions. They don't do what the Constitution requires effective representation to do.
So these low-income defendants, I mean, you look at this and you could say, well, they are getting some representation. A lawyer is helping them out with the case. It may not be, you know, Cadillac Legal Services, but isn't that enough? Aren't they getting the basic level they need to defend themselves?
The Constitution requires more than just a warm body with a bar card. It requires competent, effective representation. And, you know, it just doesn't occur when there's financial incentives to get rid of the case as soon as possible. The state of Wisconsin not only pays $40 an hour, there are instances in which they do what is called a flat fee contract, where they'll say, here's a set $248 to handle a misdemeanor case. So the attorney makes more money the quicker he or she gets rid of the case. And so there's these financial conflicts involved as well. State after state has been banning this form of compensation, most recently in Michigan and in Idaho. Not, you know, traditionally left-wing leaning states, but conservative states are banning this form of compensation.
Now, you point out in this study that Wisconsin court-appointed attorneys are paid the lowest rate in the country. What's the historical background behind that? Why did Wisconsin end up there?
I don't know if I really know fully all the background into why this occurred. And frankly, it's of less importance to us than getting it fixed. Certainly, through the 90s and early part of the century, it was difficult for people to think of funding indigent defense as anything other than giving criminals attorneys. It was easy to sort of ignore that issue. The interesting thing that's happening now is you see a consensus coming together from both the right and left that the Sixth Amendment is one of the cherished values of America, in that this is an issue of individual liberty versus the tyranny of government. So you see conservatives like Michigan Governor Snyder leading indigent defense reform. You see a state like Idaho moving to comprehensive reform. You see people like the Koch brothers giving significant resources to try to work on this issue. And so it really is a point now where conservatives are coming to this and saying, we have to do this right. And, you know, the financial cost of raising the rates could be offset by creating new programs to divert a lot of these cases out of the formal criminal justice system, thus shrinking the size of government to offset the cost.
So what are you looking for as a change here in Wisconsin, and who would have to act to make that happen?
Well, it could be legislatively done. You know, there has been a long history of asking for rate changes, and it hasn't occurred. So I think most advocates are seeing this as something that the court should do. And indeed, courts across the country have addressed this issue through court orders. So what this report recommends is that the Wisconsin State Supreme Court do an executive order requiring the compensation of counsel be set at $85 an hour and have a trigger annually like the cost of living so that it doesn't fall so dramatically behind as it has now.
David, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's David Carroll, Executive Director of the Sixth Amendment Center. He was with us to talk about the group's new study showing court-appointed defense attorneys in Wisconsin are paid the lowest rates in the country.
Have you ever heard someone complain that texting and digital communication is making us dumber? That using emojis or abbreviations in writing makes us forget how to use proper grammar?
Those people aren't alone. Media outlets like the BBC and LA Times have written articles about how text-speak is ruining the English language.
Well, our guest today disagrees. She argues that the way we communicate in text, emails, and tweets is streamlining our language and updating it for the 21st century.
Lauren Collister is a sociolinguist at the University of Pittsburgh. She joins us now to talk more about how our language is evolving right before our eyes and at our fingertips. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a pretty common complaint, Lauren, and maybe a gut feeling among a lot of people, even if they don't say it out loud. But you say, no, the effects of digital communication, neither good nor bad. It's just part of a process of change. Why is that?
Well, language has been evolving for as long as language exists. So to illustrate particularly why I feel like text speak is not actually ruining language, I've shared in my article in The New Republic in Quartz some of the research from linguists who research online language and text speak. And it turns out these forms really do interesting things with language that we haven't necessarily seen before. And this is because technology has brought written language into everyday use and in way more context than ever before.
And to put it into context, as you said, this is not the first time that in history people have cried foul over the way a language seems to be heading, that it's going down the tubes, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a really great TED Talk by linguist John McWhorter. And in this talk, he shares stories that basically come from all across time of people complaining about language change. And one example that particularly struck me was in 63 AD, this Roman scholar was grousing that students of Latin were writing in an artificial language. But that language was one that would eventually become French.
And is this common in linguistics where you're kind of pushing back against popular culture? There's a lot of griping about language change, but the linguists are saying, no, this is natural, this is evolution.
Actually, it's a really common thing to do in linguistics. We have a very descriptive approach to language, and that is that we like to look at language how it is actually used by the speakers who are actually using it out there every day in their lives, and to take that actual everyday use and analyze it and study it for signs of language change. Always in the past, we've had to get ideas of how language changed from looking at historical texts from different time periods and comparing them across times, but now we can see it happening right before our eyes in the speech that's recorded every day or written online.
Well, for instance, it sounds like we can pinpoint the very first time someone used an emoticon, and now they're so prevalent, and we have emojis and emoticons. Can you give us a little bit of the story behind them?
Well, the first ever use of emoticon is attributed to a guy at Carnegie Mellon University, and his name was Scott Fallman. And it was from 1982 in an email where he suggested the colon hyphen close parentheses, or the smiley face with a nose in it, as a joke marker to indicate sarcasm or wisecracks, because it was really hard to tell when his colleagues were being sarcastic. And he also, in that same email, used the first instance of the frown emoticon with the other parentheses in it. So this is the very first use of the emoticon that we know of, but it has really evolved into emojis now, with technology platforms evolving and changing to take advantage of new technology capabilities. We can put animated emoji and different kinds of emoji. We have the whole list on our phones that we can pull up anytime we want. We don't have to rely on sequences of symbols.
What's the advantage of the emoji? What can they convey that words can't, or what can they convey that words can't efficiently?
So emoji and emoticons are really cool because they function as what linguists call discourse markers. And discourse markers are these little bits of language that convey the tone or the overlying meaning of what we're saying. Kind of like what Scott Fallman was saying, we need a sarcasm marker so that we can understand the tone. We usually do this in spoken language with our voice or our tone. It might rise and fall to indicate these things. But when you have text only, that's not really an option. So people started using emoticons as a way to give some emotion or inflection to their writing. So, for example, I might type, I've had a great day, but if I follow it with a frown emoticon, that might indicate that I'm being sarcastic about my great day.
So it sounds like you're saying there are all these emotional layers of nuance that we can indicate in text now that we couldn't before, that you could really only do with a voice. So it's getting, I guess it sounds like you think it's making language go a little deeper.
Maybe not a little bit deeper, but it is doing a lot of conversational things that may be very difficult to do in spoken language or hard to learn or pick up on in a very condensed and concise way. Another example of this that comes from my own research is the use of the asterisk, or the star above the 8 on the keyboard. It works as a correction device in many online communities and outlets. So if I make a typo in something that I'm writing, and I don't want you to think that I really don't know how to spell that word, or maybe I have completely obscured my meaning by misspelling it. I might use that asterisk to indicate that I'm making a correction and type it out correctly. If we did this in spoken language, it would require saying, oh, oops, I mean, or I meant to say, but I actually said. So it's a very complex thing to actually say out loud that has been reduced to a single symbol in online communication.
Talking to Lauren Collister about the impact of texting in online language on the English language, she says, well, a lot of us sad face about this. There are many reasons to happy face. Lauren, one of the reasons we might sad face is this is something associated with the youth, the kids, and often there's a sense that if the kids are changing something, they're doing it wrong or making it worse over time. Do you think that's part of the reason people are upset about these changes?
Oh, absolutely. And this kids these days argument has been going on forever. So there's this famous quote from 1871 from the president of Harvard University. Charles Eliot was his name, and he's complaining about bad spelling, incorrectness, inelegance of expression in writing among young men otherwise well-prepared for college these days. And that was in 1871 at Harvard, and it's still the same refrain today. And it's this kind of complaint has been going on for a long time, but it really is the youth who are the drivers of language change because they are acquiring new forms as they're learning language and as they're learning how to socially interact with peers and getting out there in the world in new contexts. So they're taking that language that they've learned and applying it to all these various new contexts, like today, the internet and text messaging.
What do you think about how it sort of bled over into the way that we speak? Now, instead of maybe just laughing, we might just say LOL, you know, and express it that way.
Hashtag yeah.
Absolutely. It has bled into speech. In fact, a colleague of mine at the University of Pittsburgh related a story similar to what you said a few moments ago, where she was waiting in line and two students were behind her. One student said, well, I'm having such a bad hair day, frowny face. And her friend said, well, it's really humid and your hair doesn't look bad, so smiley face. And it's these emoticons getting in their way into spoken language. It's really interesting, but I want to make sure to mention that I only, as a college teacher and person who's been hanging around with people using the internet for most of my life, I only see people using these in very casual conversations. I don't think if any of these folks, those students in line behind my colleague, would go into a job interview, for example, that they would use this kind of language. This is an example of what linguists call register, the fact that our language changes depending on the context. So it could be said, in fact, that using these online forms are indicating a more casual tone of voice.
Do you think that the use of this text language, and as you said, just the fact that we are writing or typing way more than we used to in text form, is inspiring creativity, positive creation in language?
Oh, yes, of course. And I think the fact that we do have so many more casual outlets for our written language has provided people with more opportunity to express themselves in using the written word and using textual language that they may not have had before. I know that some of the students in classes that I teach are always concerned about having their formal writing in class analyzed for grammatical correctness or using commas correctly or whatever else they might be concerned about. And you know, conversely, they have many more outlets to express themselves using language and using writing and doing more with language that way that's available to them to use outside of the classroom, outside of traditional formal writing context.
So do you think that despite all the positives you're pointing out, we're really going to want to see great novels or see any great novels written with lots of emojis and hashtags and LOLZs? I mean, I'm sure they're out there already now, but would you really want a whole novel like that? Is it like another register problem?
I think that's a register problem there, too. I think strategically using these kinds of forms may add an extra layer of meaning in a novel. So if you were, for example, writing a novel about a teenager who may switch their style of speaking between talking to their friends and talking to other people, you may want to incorporate some of these, you know, casual forms into their dialogue, for example. But having the entire novel written this way may it doesn't adhere to our standards of what we expect novels to be. And while that may be very innovative and different and very cool, it's not probably not going to catch on anytime soon because we do have these longstanding traditions of what a novel really is.
Taking a longer view as we wrap up, Lauren, let's flash forward a couple hundred years and speculate, how much will the English language look like it does now? How alien will it look to us at that point?
Well, if you consider the English language of a couple hundred years ago, it's still readable to us, but there are many words and phrases that we can't make sense of or that we need to understand before we go into reading this to understand the context. With the acceleration of technology and the advent of new ways of communicating that are going on all the time, I can hardly hazard a guess. But with increasing voice-to-text capabilities that are happening more and more every day, I'm wondering if that will be an even more important part of our communication.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Lauren Collister from the University of Pittsburgh. Her recent piece on texting and language is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Yesterday, Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake lifted the citywide curfew that had been in place for five nights. The curfew was in response to unrest in response to the death of Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died of injuries he got while in police custody.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said he supports the mayor's decision and is starting to pull out National Guard troops. Now that things are at least starting to return to normal in Baltimore, a lot of analysts and experts are looking closely at how the media covered the events in Maryland's largest city.
Mike Wagner is with us to analyze media coverage of Baltimore and other stories of police and protest. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's this saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm-hmm.
Is this what happened as you see it when it comes to media coverage of Baltimore?
Well, I think it fits the pattern of how the news media cover these kinds of events, whether it's the riots in Los Angeles in 1992 or what's been happening in Baltimore over the last few weeks. And so usually you have some sort of incident that sparks interest from the community, sparks some outrage from the community. Usually these are because of long-standing issues that haven't gotten a lot of attention. And then those issues continue not to get a lot of attention because the first pictures are people in the streets. Maybe sometimes, in some cases, these unrest gets violent, and then that gets a lot of media attention. And in the first couple of days of these sorts of things, you get a lot of live information in a way that only the news media can kind of provide. And then you get repeating the same loops of violence ad nauseum, which provides much less value, but gets played much, much more, and it kind of skews people's perceptions of what's happening and why it's happening. And, you know, this has been a typical riot/unrest coverage by the news media.
And Jon Stewart has not been silent on this. Here's a clip from The Daily Show last week where he compares coverage of the riots in Baltimore against a backdrop where they don't look so different from riots by mostly white people.
The lawless, destructive riots shaking our nation. No, those are Kentucky fans. I'm sorry, after losing. The lawless... No, I'm sorry, that's Michigan State fans after winning. That's a pumpkin festival gone awry. Come on, those are just kids blowing off steam with good-natured arson. Yeah, there you go. That's the worrisome, let's call it urban violence we were looking for.
And back to Baltimore there at the end. What is your reaction when you hear that?
Well, I think it's... It shines a light on a typical problem with coverage, especially when there are violence violence erupts in response to kind of long-standing issues where a particular community, often the black community, has with those who are in political and economic power. And, you know, there's not a political or economic power you're rioting against when your basketball team loses a game, but there is often when something like what's happening in Baltimore is happening. And so that kind of stuff gets treated differently. MSNBC made a really nice point in some of the stronger coverage last week where All In's host Chris Hayes ran a long segment talking about white culture and the culture of white rioters and the culture of white lawlessness and all this kind of thing. And at the end said, if this sounds ridiculous, it sounds just as ridiculous when people say black culture and black rioters and that sort of thing. And so it brought race out in a way that it typically isn't in coverage of this kind.
Well, it's interesting that you use the phrase in a longer segment because it seems like to draw out the issues that you're talking about. social injustice, a lot of context, history. You do need a longer segment.
You do.
And we don't live in that kind of media environment in general anymore.
That's right. That's right. You need, you know, viewers and show hosts and guests and newspaper reporters willing to take the time it takes to unpack these kinds of issues. And it's so much easier to show a live shot of the people in the streets and speculate about what's going on than it is to say, well, we can trace some of this back to housing policy and the way housing policy segregated communities, and that affected how much money went to schools, and that affected how people were able to do later in life. That's a lot longer of a story to tell, and it requires expertise that the average talking head pundit who worked for one political campaign once 15 years ago has to bring to bear on television.
And you can see, if we're talking sort of just expressly about cable news right now that was reporting as it happened, that the shot they would assume people would want to see would be the fire, would be the riot. But on the other hand, you know, I follow this mostly on Twitter, and there were some amazingly powerful pictures of sort of hope and bridge building and real humanity, emotion reaching out, pictures that captured that and coverage that captured that. So is there just a natural bias based on who you are and what your medium is?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You know, part of the beauty and the problem with our current media landscape is that you can find almost any kind of coverage that you want. And so if you want to know, well, are there stories of people trying to tell complicated stories or hopeful stories about what's going on in Baltimore, you can find it on social media. But when you have the bottom line advertising dollar driven eyeballs watching your television station cable news world, they're going to be showing the video that's the most compelling, that's the most likely to get people to stop and look, and that usually is violent video.
And CNN in particular came out of this discussion about coverage with a little more critique going on. Here's an interview that aired last Tuesday. Wolf Blitzer speaking with DeRay McKesson, an activist who was in Baltimore.
But at least 15 police officers have been hurt, 200 arrests, 144 vehicle fires. These are statistics local police have put out, 15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Yeah, and there's no excuse for the 7 people that the Baltimore City Police Department has killed in the past year either, right?
We're not making comparisons. Obviously, we don't want anybody hurt, but I just want to hear there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
There should be peaceful protests, and I don't have to condone it to understand it, right? That the pain that people feel is real, and you are making a comparison. You are suggesting this idea that broken windows are worse than broken spines, right? And what we know to be true is that the police are killing people everywhere. They're killing people here. 6 police officers were involved in the killing of Freddie Gray, and we're looking for justice there.
A lot going on in that one clip. But what do you hear? What strikes you first off the
bat? The thing that strikes me the most, and I've watched that a few times now over the last couple of days, is when Wolf Blitzer says, I want to hear you say that there should be peaceful protests. That is not a reporter's job to tell a source what they're supposed to say. It is not a reporter's job to say, you need to tell me this. People can protest however they choose. And for the reporter, in this case Wolf Blitzer, to make the case that there's an appropriate way to respond is not something he should be doing as a journalist, especially on a network that is purporting to be a news coverage network and not an ideologically driven network.
Right. I mean, I think the first question he says is there's no excuse for this kind of violence, right? And then he gets another question back, which is, you know, obviously I don't agree with that. So do you think in that moment that that's a safe thing to say, that everybody agrees that there's no excuse?
I think that he's quite confident that the average CNN viewer holds that view. And so, you know, part of this is about markets and audience and who's watching. And I think he probably felt that, you know, it's always dangerous to read somebody's mind, and I don't know what's in Wolf Blitzer's heart, but I imagine he felt safe making that assumption.
Would you say that there's been racial bias in the coverage?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky thing to talk about, but when these sorts of things happen and white people are involved, they're not identified as white. And when black people are involved, they are always identified as black. And, you know, that's probably no accident. And so there is a bit of There's a bit of racial bias just in terms of how we label things. Also, whether we call them riots or unrest or, you know, revelers gone too far, like in a basketball game situation. But it's the same. A building is on fire in either case. So why is one a riot and one not?
And Wolf, also in that clip, he evokes Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and that seems as though something that he thinks everyone can agree upon, but it's not a cut-and-dried issue in this particular scenario, especially judging by the guest response. What other people have said, that sometimes you have to use violence to be heard, is what some protesters in Baltimore said. What do you think about his evocation of Dr. King?
Well, that's an easy place for the news media to go when something that isn't peaceful is going, and when this is happening. Everybody agrees that Martin Luther King was an amazing civil rights leader, and so shouldn't we all follow the example of nonviolence? But King himself often spoke about violence in a way that at least understood it, even if it wasn't his own particular strategy. And of course, you know, if we want to talk about violence and its utility in overcoming injustice, we could look to, say, the Revolutionary War or the Civil War or other things where people are quite happy to support the violence that took place when the United States broke up with England and, you know, used violence to do so.
So if you were producing the cable news on any one of these networks, maybe you think some of them did a better job than others, but mm-hmm. what would you say about getting some of the nuance in the context, the history that might be more geared towards solution or at least understanding than just here's what's happening now?
Well, you've got to do what's happening now, right? That's newsworthy. You know, if a building is on fire, if people are in the streets, if there's a curfew that's being violated, that's all worth attention. The question is how much? And I think if I was running a cable news network, what I would do is I would send people to the area and have them spend, while my live reporter was showing what's happening now, I'd give the other people 2 days to find local community activists who can talk about the context of what's going on. Well, what have they been working on in local civic groups? And what regular people do these local civic leaders deal with on a daily basis? And can we talk to them too? And then I would try to identify people in the area who study issues that are going on that relate to the topic at hand. So economic inequality or policing, a police strategy and, you know, police community relations. So I would try to find experts. I would try to find local activists and local people who can put the issue into a context, because most networks are parachuting a reporter in who, you know, haven't been to Baltimore, maybe have been there once or twice and don't know the community in the way that other folks do. I would also spend time finding out what the local newspaper is covering, what the local, public radio is doing, what the local public television is doing, and seeing people who do longer form stories on issues in the area have done, and try to find ways to bring that information into context with what's happening now.
We're talking with journalism expert Mike Wagner about how the media covered the unrest in Baltimore over the last week.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you're seeing in the media coming from Baltimore? How about other instances of police-involved deaths and the protests that followed, places like Ferguson or Madison and Milwaukee? What do you think the media could do differently, could do better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about how the media is covering the recent unrest in Baltimore with UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the way news outlets are covering Baltimore? What do you think could be done better? Do you see comparisons to the other incidents we've seen over the last year of police-involved deaths and protests in response? What kind of information do you want to see when it comes to these stories? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Mike, one issue that comes up in coverage of things that are happening in the moment, like the unrest in Baltimore last week, is that if you're covering it live, you have to have a response. You can do so much of showing and telling what's going on, but they always have to have someone on to explain it. Is that part of the problem, that we in the media today have to be so quick to respond that there isn't really time to digest and sort of assimilate what's going on and frame it properly?
It's really difficult because most people who are kind of at the ready to be the like the guest with an anchor or live on television with something is happening is probably not, you know, equipped with the kinds of things we talked about right before the news segment, which is, you know, knowing local activists, knowing people in the community, knowing what scholars have to say about the issue at hand. And so it's difficult to do anything other than to speculate or to kind of fly by the seat of your pants, which is, you know, usually the worst thing you want to be doing when you're talking live on television, especially in a case where something active is happening, where there might be a public safety issue, where there might be initial framing of a situation that might guide how all the viewers tend to think about it from that point forward. The first thing we see, you know, when we're introduced to something new has a powerful effect on how we think about it.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Sarah on the line in Lafarge. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, I didn't really have a question. I sort of just wanted to make a comment about how I perceive the media at large, not necessarily our media that we're speaking on right now, but when these things happen, like in Baltimore and Ferguson, we tend to hear a lot of, for lack of a better term, victim shaming, justification of deadly use of force against, let's face it, young black men. It's very common. And we often hear that they were perceived as a threat. They were perceived as a threat, and then they ended up dead. And oftentimes we find out later on that there were no weapons on this person, or, you know, they hadn't actually committed any act of violence. And I really wish that we could see the conversation on our local media sources and our nationwide media sources change and not justify these acts of violence happening.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for calling, Sarah. And do you perceive that too, Mike? Do you see victim shaming going on, a sense of needing to explain what happened?
Yeah, it depends on who you're reading or watching, but there is a lot of that in especially the cases that we've seen a spate of recently involving the police and a citizen that died at the hands of the police. And so often the news media will search for, well, what was that person doing before that person was killed by the police? And often that can come off as shaming the victim, right? So if someone is running from a police officer, they might be blamed for that, when in fact maybe the person was scared for their life, which then ended, right? And so there are other explanations that could also, you know, explain what's happening. And we don't get a lot of those other ones. And the main reason is that the person that we could talk to learn about their motivation has died, and so we can't interview them. And the police have an official spokesperson structure, and that's new sound, that's new audio, that's new video, and so that's a way to drive the story forward. And so the structure of the news kind of biases it in favor of the institution that is being discussed, and it often opens up an opportunity for things to be said about the victim that the victim, of course, can't refute.
Do you think there need to be protections for victims, not sort of the way you have protections for the information involving sexual assault survivors? Is that something that, if not, you know, put in place, just something that should be considered?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's always a challenge when we think about ways that we want to structurally limit what it is the news media can report, because it's very easy to go down the road of, well, when do we stop structurally limiting what it is the news media can report? But there are cases, you know, when somebody dies, usually a name isn't released until, you know, a coroner gives you a say-so as a reporter or something like that. And so, you know, there are things to think about, and or it might be a situation where journalists might want to see if the family is ready for a name to be released and those sorts of things. But, you know, when there's an officer-involved situation, so people that we're paying with our tax dollars have been involved in some kind of, you know, situation that's resulted in a citizen of the area or a human being, regardless of whether they were from the area, being killed, the public has a right to know who that was and what happened in that situation and what's going to happen afterwards.
We're talking right now with Mike Wagner, UW-Madison journalism professor, talking about media coverage of the recent unrest in Baltimore. We'll go back to the phones now and take a call from Thomas in Union Grove. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. I've been listening, and I just would like to ask your guest how much media coverage should be given to police officers that are killed in this country, and not even counting the thousands of officers that are assaulted in this country annually.
All right. Thank you, Thomas. Is there an obligation by the media not just to report on victims of maybe police violence. Many of these cases are still in play right now, but also police who've been injured or killed.
Oh, sure. And they do. In fact, kind of dispassionate content analyses of when an officer is killed versus when citizens are killed by officers, which gets more attention? The police officers getting killed gets more attention. People tend not to see that because they tend to only remember things that they don't like about the news media and not things that they do. But police officers getting killed in the line of duty gets much more attention from the news media than officer-involved shootings tend to. Police officers getting killed are less likely to result in days of wall-to-wall live coverage, like an urban unrest or a riot situation are, though. And so those kind of punctuated events that happen are wall-to-wall coverage, which tends not to happen when police officers are killed. And there's not a lot of attention when officers are hurt in the line of duty. So the caller, I think was talking about both of those kinds of things. So there's less attention given by the media when that happens, and perhaps there ought to be more of it.
And as we watch the sort of national story or movement unfolding, stories like Ferguson, stories like South Carolina with Eric Garner, what do you hope the media can give its citizenry to make them better informed and to work towards cultural solutions?
Well, it would be nice if we had more attention that focused on why there are these problems between, kind of police officers and police departments and communities and particular segments of that community. And is it just a police issue or is it something that's much larger? Is it an economic issue? Is it an issue about job opportunities? Is it an issue about education? Is it an issue about people feeling safe where they are? And so all of these things probably matter, and we don't get much attention on those things because those are it's harder to draw a direct arrow to we know this caused that, and it's also less easy to get on the air by a deadline.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about how the media covered the events in Baltimore over the last week.
So this is unusual. The world got a literary apology this weekend as J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter series, you know, those books and the movies, said she regretted having killed off one of her characters.
This weekend was the anniversary of the fictional Battle of Hogwarts, where, and here's the spoiler, cover your ears for a moment if you haven't read them, Ron Weasley's older brother Fred dies. And Rowling tweeted, "Today I would just like to say I'm really sorry about Fred," with the note that she is bowing her head in acceptance of your reasonable ire.
I didn't read that far into the series, I'll admit, or see all of the movies. When I mentioned this to you that I'd seen this, Veronica, you really jumped on it.
I think it makes perfect sense. I think her apology is a little late. I think it could have come sooner. Some of the coolest parts in those books were because of Fred and George when they punked Dolores Umbridge, put the swamp in the hall, their joke shop. I mean, how could she do that? And why wait so long to apology? I, for one, would like more.
Do you want a rewrite? Do you want her to go back and alter things with that? Didn't Hermione have that time travel thing?
The time turner.
The time turner,
that's
right.
An interesting existential question. I don't know. Let me get back to you.
Well, is this going to be a trend? Like, I mean, can you imagine authors like, Dostoevsky, like, yeah, sorry, Raskolnikov shouldn't have killed the landlady. That was a mistake.
Well, look at what George R. R. Martin is doing with two separate versions of...
He'd have to spend the rest of his days apologizing for killing beloved characters. I don't think we can really go there.
I guess you're right.